One, two, three. All right, is the camera ready? Okay. Awesome. Hello, everybody. It's my honor. I'm Andres Gomez Emilson, one of the co-founders of Qualia Research Institute. I love this conference. I'm super, super grateful to be here. And it's my honor to introduce David Pierce, who's a world-renowned transhumanist. he wrote The Hedonistic Imperative back in 1995, had a huge internet empire. If you put in your URL like mdma.net or opioids.com or one of these like super high-level domains, you will encounter an original essay by David on a lot of these like fascinating topics. And today he's gonna have a casual conversation with me. Feel free to jump in with any questions at any point. David really likes to kind of engage with the audience and he's very happy to do so. By default, he's going to go through a couple slides, and then I'm going to have a casual conversation with him. But yeah, as I said, feel free to jump in at any time. So without further ado, here's David.
Andres, thank you very much for that. Back in 1995, I wrote an online manifesto, The Hedonistic Imperative. I would have loved to have called it a moral obligation to phase out suffering throughout the living world and replace the biology of suffering by life based on gradients of bliss. I settled for the snappy title, The Hedonistic Imperative. And back in 1998, I set up with Nick Bostrom the World Transhumanist Association. Transhumanists want to create a triple S civilization of super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. Now, my focus has always been on the problem of suffering and how we can reprogram the biosphere and create a world underpinned by gradients of intelligent bliss. And in the first talk last year I gave, AI for Animals, I outlined the abolitionist project as I conceive it. In the case of humans, I think we have an obligation to offer all prospective parents access to pre-implantation genetic screening, counseling, CRISPR genome editing, so that anyone who thinks they're entitled to bring more life and suffering into the world has the opportunity to load the genetic dice in favor of their children. And manipulating even a handful of genes, the SCN9A gene, the so-called volume knob for pain, the FAR gene, and so on, it will be possible to ratchet up hedonic set points and pain thresholds. It's obviously hugely ambitious. An awful lot can go wrong. All children born today are untested genetic experiments, but if we are willing to edit our genetic source code, essentially it is possible to create a hypothymic civilization. Someone who is hypothymic, and one can point to rare examples today, has an extremely high hedonic set point and essentially goes through life animated by information-sensitive gradients of well-being. And if we are willing to edit our genetic source code, we can create an entire hypothymic civilization. Now, what lies beyond this hypothymic civilization? This is more speculative. There doesn't seem any reason in principle why we can't continue to edit our source code, rewrite the genome, and create literally life based on gradients of superhuman bliss. And if you're a classical utilitarian, this presumably is what we should be aiming for. My own focus is on fixing the problem of suffering. Three strands, really, to the abolitionist project as I conceive it. First, humans. Essentially, if we go on churning out Darwinian malware as we do today, there will be suffering will proliferate indefinitely. Something like 800,000 people take their own lives each year. World Health Organization estimates that perhaps 270 million people worldwide are clinically depressed. Unspeakable suffering. But CRISPR genome editing means that the problem of suffering is now in principle fixable. In the case of non-human animals, I would love to just, you know, rely on moral arguments and say that, look, a pig or a cow is as sentient as a small child. We should not be abusing them in factory farms. We should be aiming to help sentient beings rather than harm them. In practice, the quickest way to end the horrors of animal agriculture is going to be cultured meat, farm-free animal products. Now, this might seem to tie in with my theme of genome reform, and in one sense it does, but from a purely marketing perspective, it's probably best to suggest that cultured meat, farm-free animal products is not genetically engineered. It could be, you know, enhanced flavor, texture, nutritional value, but it's going to be much safer to say it's, inverted commas, natural. And I would urge lobbying, for example, if legislation were enacted that calls for the outlawing of slaughterhouses in, let's say, 2035, the clock will be ticking and it creates a tremendous commercial incentive for the development, commercialization of cultured meat. And if you ask them, people purely in the abstract, would you favor abolishing slaughterhouses? There was this astonishing poll a few years ago, something almost over 40% of people said they'd favor abolishing slaughterhouses. Not berating them for eating meat, just in the abstract, how terrible it is that slaughterhouses exist. And realistically, the best way to have global veganism or in vitrotarianism this century is going to be to ensure negligible inconvenience to consumers. And most people, if they have two identical products in a supermarket, will go for the cruelty-free option. And if we are willing to develop cultured meat, then yeah, essentially it would be possible to end the horrors of animal agriculture. The third strand of the abolitionist project on Earth is the problem of wild animal suffering. Naively, it's completely intractable, problem of predation. However, what's the real game changer is synthetic gene drives that cheat the laws of Mendelian inheritance. And it's going to be possible to use genome editing to spread benign genes, for example, benign versions of the SCN9A gene, across entire free-living species. It's going to be possible to herbivorize predators so that they cease to do terrible things to herbivores. And it's going to be possible to use CRISPR-based gene drives for the purposes of tunable cross-species fertility regulation. Now, this probably sounds far-fetched, first of all, and it is far-fetched in one sense. First of all, we'll be able to set up artificial biospheres, inevitable teething problems, but in principle, the whole biosphere is programmable, and the level of suffering is an adjustable parameter. That, in a nutshell, is the abolitionist project as I conceive it. Please feel free to interject with queries now. As you may have gathered, I haven't got a set text. In the second talk I gave last year, I was discussing some of the things that could go wrong. And the example I gave of something that goes catastrophically wrong is, imagine a world elsewhere in our galaxy where the abolitionist project has been implemented and its inhabitants live lives underpinned by gradients of bliss in their wildlife parks. Herbivores and ex-predators dwell peacefully. This might seem in one sense a utopia, and it is, but they made a catastrophic error. They thought they were alone in their galaxy. And they were wrong. What they should have done is send out spacefaring probes and rescued suffering, pain-ridden Darwinian life here on Earth. Now, that's a kind of non-obvious ethical catastrophe, that they underestimated the power of rational agency, rational moral agency to mitigate suffering in the world. And the peg for today's talk, and this, there are three particular risks I wanted to explore. One, if one's soul value is either negative utilitarian or Buddhist. I mean, Buddha said, I teach one thing, allegedly one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Isn't the most simple and elegant way to end all suffering simply to end all life? And anyone today, for example, with a cluster headache or something terrible like a cluster headache, or someone who is suffering from suicidal despair, if they could, they would bring the rest of the world down with them. And in that sense, in a world of artificial intelligence and increasingly likely artificial superintelligence, the very existence of suffering itself is a potential X risk, essentially, that, I mean, for obvious reasons, I don't want to go into too many detailed technical questions, but later this century and beyond, there will be ways to effectively commit omnicide. And if one is a life lover, if one thinks life is fundamentally good, if one is a classical utilitarian, if one is a religious, if one wants to preserve life, and it's true, I think the future of life in our cosmos could be sublime, then one needs to be thinking about possible sources of X risk. And the very existence of suffering is nihilistic. Nihilist, essentially, suffering wants not to exist. And I'll be candid here, as a negative utilitarian, someone appalled by the existence of suffering, I too would be a button presser, so to speak. I won't go into more details. However, what I urge, can we go on to the next slide? Yes. My urge on negative utilitarian grounds to enshrine in law the sanctity of life, not because I literally believe that life is sacred, because I think it's likely to lead to better outcomes. And likewise with AI, I think it is going to be important to ensure that we code our AI to treat life as sacred and inviolate. What that means in practice, that I'm less clear. And I feel very self-conscious urging for enshrining the sanctity of life in law and code. But I think the consequences of not doing so could be disastrous. I mean, the same way as I think, you know, someone like the effective altruist movement, FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, utilitarians often miscalculate, whether they're classical utilitarians or negative utilitarians. I think it will be best to go down this route. Now, feel free to agree or disagree.
If you think all life is sacred, does it then follow that all life is necessarily better than death, and so therefore preserving life that is suffering is more important than ending life that is suffering?
You see, I've got to be very careful here, because I regard Darwinian life as utterly monstrous. I'll be candid. Hopefully everyone here is relaxed, comfortable, convivial. But basically, even experiencing so-called moderate pain, people are shocked at how bad it is. The severest forms of pain, torture, cluster headaches I mentioned, are unspeakable. Right now, It would be more apt if I were to actually portray some of the ghastliness going on right now in the world. The sort of sentient beings being eaten alive, asphyxiated, disemboweled. Darwinian life is, I regard it as monstrous. However, if one starts talking in this vein, Essentially, one alienates people, and to fix the problem of suffering, we need to build the broadest possible coalition of life lovers, secular, religious people. And if one thinks of the, for example, pain-free surgery, it was controversial for about 15 years, but it wasn't necessary when introducing pain-free surgery to agree on a theory of ethics. Utilitarianism, positive, classical, negative, anything. Essentially, a coalition arose. It was the appropriate thing to do. And if we are to persuade people worldwide to embrace, probably won't be called the abolitionist project, it could be something as the World Health Organization conception of health, we need to build coalitions. And any talk of ending Darwinian life essentially alienates people. Now, in one sense, genetically reprogramming the biosphere, creating a living world underpinned by gradients of bliss, I mean, it is ending Darwinian life, but it doesn't trigger the same negative reaction as if one says that life is... as I said, it does feel faintly absurd saying, yeah, let's enshrine the sanctity of life in law, human and non-human. But in purely consequentialist terms, I think it's best, it's the best thing to do.
Should I move on to the next slide? Or any comment on this?
So it sounds like you're drawing some relatively hard distinction, maybe ontologically, between Darwinian life and non-Darwinian life, or Darwinian evolution and selection versus non-Darwinian evolution and selection. Do you also make a hard distinction between biological life and non-biological life in terms of their capacity for suffering or the form of their evolution?
This actually comes into the point I'm making here now, avoiding catastrophic risks. I think that for purely technical reasons, there is no way our machines with existing architectures are going to wake up. This is the phenomenal binding problem. Background assumptions, I'm a physicalist, no strong emergence. Even if the fundamental stuff of the world, the essence of the physical, the fire in the equations is consciousness, is raw experience, there is simply no way, if physicalism is true, that classical digital computers, AI run on whether classical Turing machines, LLMs, can support phenomenally bound subjects of experience with a pleasure-pain axis. And so imaginably, think of a so-called whole brain emulation, or what naively is a whole brain emulation. Imagine replacing the ones and zeros with discrete micropixels of experience. Execute the code as before. The upshot of running the program isn't a phenomenally bound subject, a mind, running a world simulation right now. The upshot is a so-called micro-experiential zombie. And how is it? I can, if you're interested, go on to give a potential physicalist account of phenomenal binding, for what it's worth. I think we are front of mind running classical world simulations. But this kind of stuff is only of any interest to someone who really groks the binding problem. And in a nutshell, I think in a fundamentally quantum world, decoherence makes otherwise impossible classical computing physically feasible and simultaneously precludes classical digital computers, LLMs, from solving the binding problem. The phenomenal binding is insanely computationally powerful. If anyone doubts this, imagine if you had integrative agnosia and could only see a mane, jaws, and teeth, but couldn't see a lion. Or imagine if you had simultanagnosia and you can only see one object at once. Or imagine if you have akinetopsia and can't see motion. Phenomenal binding is computationally functioning, incredibly powerful, and yet neuroscience doesn't know how it's possible. Sorry, you're going to say,
Are you making the case that consciousness only emerges from sufficient levels of quantum entanglement?
Binding.
Okay.
I said, my tentative solution, all possible solutions to the hard problem of consciousness are intuitively absurd. My working assumption, no more, is non-materialist physicalism. It's what philosophers call the version of the intrinsic nature argument, that there's simply no evidence that the intrinsic nature of the world's fundamental quantum fields differs inside and outside the head. But even if this is the case, and I said it's my working assumption, how is it that phenomenal binding is possible? Because if textbook neuroscience is correct, and you are a pack of 86 billion effectively decohered, membrane-bound classical neurons communicating via electrical and chemical synapses, you should be at most a micro-experiential zombie. It was William James back in 1910 who first recognized the binding or combination problem. I mean, why aren't we, even if consciousness is fundamental, why aren't we just aggregates of mind dust? And my friend, colleague, Andres, recently has been writing extensively on the binding problem. I would recommend checking out the his blog. I gave a talk at Tucson a few years ago, Schrodinger's neurons. Critical point here, well, two critical points. One is if someone claims that phenomenal binding is non-classical, this isn't just a philosophical opinion, it's testable. And I think it's really important that we get this question right, because, as I said, the theme of this afternoon is avoiding ethical catastrophes. What if I'm wrong? What if I'm mistaken? What if AI, whether whole brain emulations or something else, does somehow wake up, generate a mind with a pleasure-pain axis? We want to avoid ethical catastrophes. And obviously it's extremely contentious. I mean, one of the pioneers who, you know, Eliezer Yudkowsky, fellow transhumanist, Eliezer does not believe that non-human animals and babies are human babies are conscious. And here am I today arguing essentially that however sophisticated, however super intelligent classical AI becomes, essentially it's going to be inherently of no moral status. And I should probably say that, I mean, here's a back to another example again, that the ability to something like to play chess, you can, you know, someone who can see 32 pieces on the chessboard has got a tremendous computational functional advantage over someone with simultaneous who only see one. But nonetheless, Stockfish outperforms all human chess players with no functionally relevant phenomenal binding. I'm not arguing here precisely what are the upper bounds to zombie intelligence. What I'm saying is that there is no way that Stockfish can wake up, and there is no way that already generative AI can outperform humans on almost, you know, I'm much candidly rather talk to a generative AI than almost any human on most topics. That our machines are increasingly cognitively outperforming us,
but not conscious, and therefore not with no moral standing.
And no moral standing. But of course, it's vital to get this right. So many people just talk complete nonsense about consciousness binding. I'm aware of the fact that I could do it too.
Would you say more about the binding problem?
One note is, we started a little bit late, so I guess like maybe we can go for like five more minutes, but I know there's like David...
The next session's at like 12:30, so feel free to...
Okay. Yeah, also like David has like office hours until like 1 p.m.
Okay.
So and also I researched quite a lot on the binding problem. I'm very happy to talk more about that.
Yeah.
But I guess like in the interest of taking advantage of the container, like I want to make sure like if there's anybody else who has like a question for David, I think like the last slide is like other risks discussion.
So there's like the review of like this abolitionism, and then the main claim is like AIs are probably not morally? Is this like the main point of the like the person or like?
Essentially, ever since the past 30 years, I have been putting forward, you know, the abolitionist project blueprint, what is technically involved. Mm-hmm. But one lesson of history is that utopian dreams can go horribly wrong. And one wants to cover all the possible, the unknown unknowns. But what are the different ways that trying to fix the problem of suffering can go wrong? And one, and a very pertinent one, given the rise of artificial intelligence, maybe soon artificial superintelligence, is the question of AI, potential digital S risks, suffering risks, if you believe in minds. In the case of the abolitionist project, though I focus on creating life based on information-sensitive gradients of bliss, it will also be possible to use smart prostheses. But if one is a functionalist of one particular description, then a neuroprosthesis can suffer too. As I said, I feel I've struggled to steel man the case for digital minds. I mean, I steel manned in my last talk the case for cosmic rescue missions, even though I'm tentatively a rare earther who thinks, owing to the so-called thermodynamic miracle of life's origin, we're probably alone in our Hubble volume. But it's important to get this right. And yeah, as I said, perhaps the focus of today's talk has been, are our machines going to wake up? If they do, are they going to support minds with a pleasure-pain axis? If so, what are the ethical implications? And I haven't very successfully steel-manned the case, but I think it's fair to say that no one has a classical account of phenomenal binding.
He's like, do you want to also make sure you talk about C's?
Yes. Perhaps, can we just, it's in the same directory.
Oh, in the same directory?
Yeah, but unfortunately not. It hasn't yet been integrated in this.
You mean like...
It's, if you just type in the same directory.
Oh, so you mean like the URL?
URL, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
And just type in cs.pdf.
Okay, so it'll be like here... Just the last one? Yeah. C-E-A-S-E.
As in cease, stop.
Uh-huh. C's dot?
Dot.
Just PDF. It's just a PDF.
Okay. What? I don't know what... Okay. One second.
Oh, here, let me do this.
Okay.
There we go.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sir?
Now, I would recommend anyone who would like actively to get involved with the project, as distinct from just philosophize, which is what I do, to email CEASE, Center for the Abolition of Suffering. And this is, it's newly launched. I hope it's going to be a great success. Building a successful organization is so radically different from philosophizing or drawing up blueprints. I'm not going to say a great deal now about CEASE, but I very much hope that a little abolitionist ecosystem is going to arise. I mean, we haven't really touched on how we can go from the fringe to the mainstream. I don't know it's going to happen. Part of me still yearns for the so-called great man theory of history, that Elon Musk is going to stumble across something like this and say, let's use biotechnology to fix the problem of suffering. And suddenly it becomes mainstream. and, you know, probably be called Edenism or something, or something, or something like this. But then we hit the mainstream. There's also another approach which just relies on so-called technological determinism, that as the technology matures, it's just going to remorselessly unfold. And, you know, we're already seeing in the USA now embryo screening. We need a happy baby company that is going to embryo screen for alleles, allelic combinations associated with well-being. Then we need genome editing because embryo screening is slow. But I would heartily, and many thanks to my friend Martin, who has taken the initiative here. You probably recognize Andres here. Scott Alexander, no introduction, needs no introduction. I'm not going to attempt to give a potted biography of everyone involved. But if anything I've said has resonated, do please get in touch.
Just to say a couple words. I've known Marcin for many years. He's supported the Qualia Research Institute in lots of ways. It's been patently clear that there's been kind of a gap in terms of institutes for one that actually supports David Pierce's vision in the form of a kind of bureaucratized organization, where we actually consider the word bureaucratized actually good in this context, just in terms of actually moving the project forward. I have a huge amount of respect for Marcin and his organizational building capacity. So definitely check it out and get in touch if you're interested in any of these topics. In particular, really taking extreme suffering very seriously and pragmatic interventions against it. But then also really the big picture of hey, how do we actually get rid of suffering for good in the long term? There's another kind of interesting aspect of this organization having to do with interest in soteriology and personal identity in terms of what would salvation actually look like? And for that, we actually need also really good philosophy of personal identity, which involves questions such as is it actually you who's going to wake up tomorrow in your own body, or is it each moment of experience its own different subject? And we think that's actually an empirically tractable question, as crazy as that may sound. So I guess maybe any last question for David before we move on to the office hours? Go ahead.
Yeah, so phenomenal presentation, David. I had one question. So obviously, let's say we succeed, we get everything done that you're saying. What about death itself? Do you think that we ought to live forever? So say we can somehow reverse aging, for example, right? Do you think that, say, animals, they should live forever, or what are your thoughts on that? I'm just generally curious.
I very much hope that we can fix the problem of aging. Whereas we can right now outline a roadmap for fixing the problem of suffering, even with a handful of genetic tweaks, science does not yet know how to fix the problem of aging. And I think essentially cryonics, even the option of cryothanasia, but cryonics should be opt out. So essentially we can offer something for everyone, that no one need feel that they're missing out. I mean, there's something almost cruel about telling people science is going to find a cure for aging after you're dead. And having said that, I confess personally, I'm a skeptic about enduring metaphysical egos, that I'm nice. If asked, I say yes, I'm probably going to get cryothanased at 75 or something like that. I don't think post-human superintelligence would consider it ethical to reanimate Darwinian malware. Sure, whatever killed me could be fixed and I could be re-engineered to be superintelligent gradients of bliss, but in what sense would that entity be me? But yes, I think it is important to fix aging. As I said, transhumanists believe in a triple S civilization of superintelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. Although I said that science doesn't know how to fix the problem of aging, and it could well be next century and beyond with superintelligence, even if you think it's zombie superintelligence, there's a sense in which all bets are off. So in the case of non-human animals, how far down, apologies for the biological illiteracy, how far down the phylogenetic tree does one want to go? I mean, if radical anti-aging technologies become available, people are going to make sure they want their dogs can live an indefinite lifestyle. Elephant, you know, intuitively elephants, but yeah, what about small rodents and so forth? But yeah, I mean, in the long run, the whole biosphere is programmable. What starts as mere genetic tweaking is probably going to end up as radical genetic rewrites. Freeman Dyson said that a future generation of artists will rewrite genomes in the same way that the poets, you know, wrote verses. Yeah, genome editing can be used for more morally serious purposes than art.
Absolutely. And another question I had as well, since you mentioned Dyson, so do you think we'd have to like expand the planet somehow to sustain life? So say like we managed to, right? And there's like, I don't know, like 20 billion people or something, right? Do you think that we'd have to go into space, or like do you think that we could somehow sustain it on Earth, just out of curiosity? So I'm thinking like, would we go basically a Dyson sphere almost, but for humans and life in general? If that makes any sense.
I very mixed feelings, how was it? Is it more likely that if humans radiate beyond the solar system, we will be spreading bliss or simply more pain and misery? But once we have fixed the problem of suffering, that even from my strict negative utilitarian perspective, there is nothing wrong with going out and spreading life based on gradients of bliss. In practice, I think this is more likely to come via digital AI printing out the equivalent of biospheres than biological humans and transhumans. It's easy to underestimate the challenges of spacefaring, but I'm agnostic here.
Gotcha. All right, well, I really appreciate your question, so thank you, David.
Can I ask another question? I don't know if there's like a time thing. I know for sure like we have another event at 12:30, but
I'm just
wondering. I'm happy to chat until someone comes in and wants to do it. As long as I've done my duty.
I would love to hear more like animal welfare ideas. I thought that these were like very, very interesting, like gene drives and stuff like this. This is relatively new to like this type of stuff. So if there's like a resource or a list, you know, something like that, of just like, oh, here's some interventions where once the AIs get very, very good at R&D, which like I would expect to happen soon. We could like start engineering pretty interesting, you know, things
even
to like reduce
something. I'll find it.
two angles here. One is that every cubic meter, or indeed every cubic millimeter of the planet will shortly be accessible to surveillance, micromanagement, and control. Now this opens up options, the dystopian, you know, the world as a kind of global panopticon, big brother, dystopian scenarios, but it also means that nanobots can essentially patrol the biosphere and prevent accidents. But this hasn't been my particular focus. My focus has been on spreading benign genes and allelic combinations across tens of thousands of free living species. Now, naively, one imagines that, sure, it's going to be possible to help large terrestrial vertebrates, but what about small, fast breeders in Amazonia and the oceans? But let's say one chooses, and this was the example I gave in my, this is the welfare state for elephants. Elephants breed too slowly for gene drives to make an impact for sort of hundreds of years. But in the case of small fast breeders, let's say one finds, let's say I focused on my original gene drives paper a decade ago on the SCN9A gene, the so-called volume knob for pain. Now, nonsense mutations of SCN9A, they don't just abolish pain, but they abolish nociception, which is, we want to preserve nociception, but SCN9A gene has dozens of different variants, some associated with truly ghastly syndromes, man on fire syndrome, others on the other hand associated with full functionality but just a very high pain tolerance and pain threshold. And if we want to turn for non-human animals pain into just a useful signaling mechanism, so to speak, choose a benign version of SCN9A, release a few hundred genetically modified organisms of the desired species, and thanks to gene drives, which cheat the laws of Mendelian inheritance, the benign, low-pain version of the gene in question will actually spread across the entire species. Now, synthetic gene drives are first probably going to be used in Africa to defeat vector-borne disease, in that, for example, if all Anopheles mosquitoes only have males, then this will lead to a population crash and no more malaria. But tunable drives can, in principle, be used for all kinds of purposes, from herbivorization, fertility regulation, hedonic uplift. Wild animal suffering is one of those problems that really needs to be tackled on a global level, that ad hoc interventions don't really work. That, you know, starving herbivores in winter, if one is compassionate-minded, one wants to feed them. But this leads to a population explosion. So as well as phasing out predation, we're going to need to use cross-species fertility regulation. Now, in one sense, this discussion feels almost surreal, because it's almost intuitively crazy to start talking about humans systematically helping non-human animals in nature while we're systematically harming them in factory farms. So why have the discussion now? But if we don't have the discussion now, then animal activists will waste time and resources on misguided initiatives such as rewilding, captive breeding programs, all kinds of stuff like that. So we need to have, at least as a regulative ideal we should be striving for, a happy biosphere underpinned by gradients of bliss. So it's important to have the debate now, even if realistically the kind of sculpting of nature via synthetic gene drives is several decades away.
Yeah, and also just very very specifically, you asked for a kind of reading list. I would recommend these three essays, which is all by David, which is A Welfare State for Elephants, Compassionate Biology, which is about gene drives, and Reprogramming Predators, which is a classic from many years ago.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
I guess over there, yeah.
Yeah, I had a question about the, you were talking about genes that regulate the pain threshold, and you also mentioned some gene that affects the hedonic set point. Mm-hmm. What is the, I'm not sure if it's like knocking out the gene in humans that changes the hedonic set point, but like what is the effect size for the, because it's a strong effect on the hedonic set point?
And I'm going to mention the case of Joe Cameron. She was in the news a few years ago. Frustratingly, her full genome is not yet in the public domain. But Jo is someone who thought she was completely normal. She's a retired vegan Scottish school teacher, essentially immune from depression, never gets anxious, extraordinarily high hedonic set points, pain threshold, childbirth felt like a tickle. But unlike people with classic congenital insensitivity to pain, she was, you know, high functioning. Her father seems to have had this, I'm going to say, disorder. Now, at least at first blush, the reason for her syndrome is that she has an almost unique dual mutation. Now, it was known that the mutation of the FAR gene in question leads to elevated levels of anandamide, from the Sanskrit for bliss, and people with this mutation of high pain thresholds, high hedonic set points, low anxiety. She has a dual mutation, the so-called, what's been called the far out gene, which was originally thought to be nonsensical, and this may account for her, I mean, calling it high rather trivializes her state, because she's socially responsible, vegan, caring, you know, a thoroughly decent human being. I'm adding all these caveats and provisos in that, because until we actually get her full genome sequenced and the genome of her biological relatives, who knows what other surprises are there. But the FAR gene is certainly relevant, and probably the FAR out gene too. And I mean, this is illustrative. There are a handful of other genes, the mu opioid receptor, the COMPS gene, but it doesn't involve But though, as I said, hundreds of different genes are implicated in pain processing and hedonic tone, even a handful of genetic tweaks could essentially defang the problem of suffering. Yeah.
Yeah, really.
I was going to say, I do need to set up for my talk in a second, but
I was just going to say that there's an office hours room on floor 3 if people would like to continue, if David wants to continue the conversation, then I would
Yeah, essentially, I'm very happy to chat, but I don't want to,
Excellent. Everyone would like to go up to the...
around 5 minutes after.
Oh, okay.
Cool. Thank you, David.